All right, so we are holding on your test on the bays a bit past the middle of the armored. The line begins by Fanina. We learned yesterday about the question, are you allowed to, if you have grapes or olives that were broken up a little bit, that were broken up a bit, it's called risuk, before Shabbos, are you allowed to then put the beam or the whatever, the thing, that the beam or the round thing or whatever on them that causes them to the part of the press that causes more juice to get squeezed out of them, are you allowed to do that on Shabbos?
So on the pressing beam, right?
Well, so in the case of olives, it's more like one long, it's more like a long, heavy beam, more shaped, more like a beam. In the case of grapes, the Mishnah had called it igulei hagas, which means the round thing of the wine press, because there they use something more like a flat, like a, not flat, yeah, more like a flat, round thing. Whatever it is, it amounts to the same thing. They're using it to press on the grapes or olives and get more juice out. So we said that both Bishama and Bishil agree you're allowed to do that. So we said, though, that not all the Tanoim would agree to that. That might be only according to Rabbi Shmuel or only according to Rabbi Elazar, because other Tanoim might argue and say that even though they were broken up already, that's not enough to be able to press them on Shabbos. The last thing we said was that Rabbi Yochanan had said that actually there's a difference how many processes have been done to them. Has it just been that risuk was done, the initial breaking them up, or do you actually have to have that dicho was done, which is more crushing them, and some of the Tanoim might then say that even when dicha is done and just shchika has not been done yet, they haven't actually been ground up, then it would still be also to do it. Okay. Anyway, continues the Gemara. Shemen shel badadim. What about when it comes to the oil that's given to the olive press workers? This is how Rashi learns it. We'll talk in a second. Tosfos says differently. But Rashi says that now the Gemara is sort of digressing. Since we talked about pressing grapes and olives, so now the Gemara is going to digress to talk about another din involving oil that's in the olive press. Now, what happens is, Rashi explains, when you press olives, you collect as much as possible of the olive oil because you're going to use it yourself or sell it or what have you. Inevitably, though, there's some that's left that you weren't able to, there's some left, inevitably, that you weren't able to get. And the usual way of doing things is those bits of oil that are left are given to the olive press workers. So now the question is, the question will be, is it considered mukta on Shabbos? So shemet shabbat dadin, umachsolos shabbat dadin, also the mats that are used by the olive press workers, that are used to cover the olives before or after the press, as the case may be. So those, Rav also Shmuel shori. So in both those cases, Rav says that they're mukta, and Shmuel holds that not. Now we have a general, as the Gemara is going to point out in a minute, we have a general machloikus in many places in the Sechta Shabbos between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon about how much is the scope of mukta. You have, now we know that Rabbi Shimon agrees that there are certain kinds of things that are mukta, as we'll eventually say, but he holds by a very narrow definition of mukta. Even with his narrow definition, we still have quite a few categories of mukta, but we have Rabbi Yehuda holds a more expansive definition, as we'll see in various places in the Masechta. One example is on the question of Nolad, for example. You have something that was created new on Shabbos. Is it also or not? Rabbi Shimon would say yes, Rabbi Yehuda would say no. But you have various other things also where Rabbi Shimon holds that something is not mukta and Rabbi Yehuda holds it is. So Rashi explains that in both of these cases, the oil and the mat that we're talking about are both at the question of mukta. The oil, because it's meant to be given to the olive press workers, and therefore it's like it's off limits to you. You didn't have intention before Shabbos to use it because you intended to save it for the olive press workers. And the mats, because they're being used to cover things in the olive press, and therefore they're not really used for anything else. So Rav also Shmuel Shori. Rav would say it's also to handle them on Shabbos. Shmuel would say it's mutter. Tosfos has a different understanding that it is actually more directly related to what we talked about in the Gemara before. We talked about whether you're allowed to put the beam on the olives that have been broken up or crushed or whatever, if you're allowed to put the beam on them before Shabbos and have the oil continue being squeezed out of them on Shabbos. So now the question is, even if we say that you, even if we said that you did that, Rav would say that that oil would be mukta on Shabbos because it's noilad, because it didn't exist in its present form before Shabbos began. So, in effect, in other words, the juice, the oil, whatever, didn't exist before Shabbos began. Because before we said in the Gemara before, we made a distinction between something that originally was food and now is also food, versus before it was food and now it's a liquid, and that's how it is with the oil. Because first it's inside the olives, and therefore, in effect, it's part of the food, part of the olives, and now it's becoming a liquid. So therefore, Tosfos learns that that's what Rav is saying. Therefore, you wouldn't be able to handle that oil on Shabbos, not like Rashi says, because it's reserved for the olive press workers, but because it was pressed out on Shabbos. Even if we say that you're allowed to put the bean there and have it be squeezed out over Shabbos, but it would be also to use that oil on Shabbos itself, Rav says. Whereas Shmuel says it would be mutter. So one second.
So then any liquid that's in any fruit, not only grapes, that's being pressed, let's say, on Shabbos.
So actually, we're going to talk about much later in the Masechta. We're going to talk about in the Kuf Mem. So we have a few months to go before we get to it, Ez Hashem. But so we're going to talk about various dinim over there about squeezing fruit on Shabbos. What's osur, what's mutter, what you're allowed to use, what we're not allowed to use. So wait until then, and we'll discuss it then. Anyway, then as far as the mat. Tosfos says, the vote about the mats, it's not so much that they're just used for the olive press. The point is that because they're used to cover the olives as part of the pressing process, they become very dirty with oil. Therefore, it would be a case of mukta machmas mius. It would be a form of mukta where you don't use it on Shabbos because repulsive, because disgusting. So again, Rav would hold that such a thing is mukta, and Shmuel would hold that it's not. Similarly, since we're talking about that, let's talk about some other things that are used for that. Some other things that have various other uses, and are they mukta or not? Hani karchi gezuzi. You also have, for example, the mats that are used to cover the merchandise in a ship. Zuzi, Rashi explains, comes from a word meaning a pair, like the word zug, and the reason is because the mats are made to come in pairs, so they cover the merchandise like a tent. Anyway, the point is, they're reserved for that purpose. So again, Rav also, Shmuel Shari, again, Rav is going to say that they are also to handle on Shabbos, because you wouldn't want to use them for any other purposes. Because you want them to be reserved for that purpose. And Shmuel would say it's mutter. So Tosfos explains that it's not so much the fact that they're used to cover merchandise. Tosfos says, again, it's another case of mukta machmas mius. They're used to cover fish that's on the boat or whatever. So therefore they become filthy, and therefore you wouldn't normally want to use them for anything else during the week, and therefore they're also to handle on Shabbos, according to Rav. Okay. Another case, Amar of Nachman, Eiz L'chalava. Now let's talk about Mukta on Yom Tov. Suppose you have a goat which you're using for milk. You don't intend to shech this goat and eat it. You're just using it for the milk. V'rocha L'gizasa, or you have a sheep that you're using for its wool. Again, you could conceivably shech it, but you prefer to keep it around and be able to shear the wool off every so often. V'tanagolos L'beitzasa, or you have a chicken that you're keeping around for the eggs. The Tota Dividia, or an ox that's used for plowing, the Tamrid Iska, and also dates that are being used for business. You're not intending to eat them yourself. You're planning to take them someplace else and sell them. So all those things, Rav also Shmuel Amar Mutter. In all those five cases, also Rav would say that they're all also. To use on Yom Tov, let's say we're talking about. So in the case of the animals, for example, conceivably you could shech them on Yom Tov, but because you didn't have in mind before Yom Tov to use them for food, you were keeping them around for the milk or the eggs or the wool or what have you. Then therefore Rav would say they're osur, that they're mukta, and Shmuel would say that they're mutter because after all they do have a potential use on Yom Tov.
I remember when we went into the first round, we spoke about this. Let's say you have a sheep that it looks like it's going to die. It won't make it. So to save it, you go ahead and shecht it, fiyamtif, and eat it. can you do that or not? You know, we
right. So that's actually that's a bit of a different case. And as is a shame, we have to base there in due time. We'll get to that. But right, here,
okay,
here,
I'll wait.
You're not getting into that level of detail, but right. Okay.
Good.
Anyway, so all those things, Rav says they're muktzah, Shmuel says they're not right. So actually, in all these machloikas that we just described, Rav and Shmuel are actually arguing about within the same machloikas as Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, where again, Rabbi Yehuda holds that Rabbi Yehuda holds of a more expansive concept of muktzah, and in particular in our case, it means that you're not allowed to shecht an animal on Yom Tov unless you pre-designated it for the purpose before Yom Tov, and in this case you didn't, whereas Rabbi Shimon does not hold of that kind of muktzah. So that would be the machlokes. And the same thing, according to Tosfos, if we're talking about when we go back to the Shemen Shabbat Dodin, the oil that was pressed out on Shabbos, because you put the beam on before Shabbos, and we're saying that Rab said it's Osir on the grounds of Nolud, Shmuel would say it's Mutter because he holds like Reb Shimon, that Nolud is not Osir on Shabbos. The actual halacha on that is, in some of these machlokes in over here, the halacha is like Rab, and some of them it's like Shmuel, because we do hold of a certain number of categories of muktzah, but not some others. We don't hold, for example, when it comes to animals for Yom Tov, you don't have to have pre-designated them before Yom Tov. So that's your case over there, for example, about the animal that was sick and you're shechting it on Yom Tov in order not to lose it altogether. So the actual final halacha is that such a thing is muktzah. On the other hand, for example, when it comes to Nolad, there we say it depends on the difference between Shabbos and Yom Tov. Shabbos, we say Nolad is Mutter in general. Yom Tov, we say it's Osir. Yom Tov, we're more Machmir, like Rabbi Yehuda, in Nolad and certain other categories of Mukta, for one thing, because since Yom Tov, you're allowed to do Malachas Eichel Nefesh, the Chachamim didn't want us to get careless and think that maybe we don't have to be careful about Yom Tov altogether. So therefore, they imposed a stricter definition of Mukta, Rabbi Yehuda's definition of Mukta, on Yom Tov.
Okay. Which is what? What's his definition?
Rabbi Yehuda holds that there are more categories of muktzah than Rabbi Shimon does. So in particular, in these cases, you have, for example, Nolad is one of them, something that came into existence on Shabbos or Yom Tov. Part of it depends, again, on the question of what exactly are we saying is the grounds that these various things that we're mentioning here in the Gemara are also. For example, again, as far as the Shemen Shabbat Dabin, Rashi would say that the oil is, that appointed Rav, that appointed Rabbi Yehuda, the oil is muktzah because you have it reserved to give to the workers, so Rabbi Shimon would not hold of that kind of muktzah. On the other hand, if we say, like Tosfos is saying, that it's a matter of Nolad, then also you would say that Nolad doesn't apply on Shabbos, at least not to the same extent. So therefore, it would be mutter to use it on Shabbos. So we'll get to in various places in our Masechta, towards the end in particular, we'll talk about, eventually in Bez Hashem and Masechta Beitza, we'll talk about this concept that Reb Shimon holds of a narrower definition of mukta than Reb Yehuda does. Reb Shimon still agrees there are certain kinds of mukta, and this is, we have in the halachas of Shabbos, as we keep them nowadays, and in Shulchan Aruch, you can find there are several simonim on the dinim of mukta. Altogether, there are six or seven kinds of mukta on Shabbos. But Rabbi Yehuda holds of even more of them, which at least as far as Shabbos, we don't hold of.
Without getting into the discussion of mukta specifically, but is mukta midrabanan?
Mukta is midrabanan. Yeah, we are going to talk about mukta extensively also in the 17th parak of our Masechta. So in the Kufchot, we have a whole parak. It's a short parak, but it's a whole parak that talks about the dinim of mukta. So we'll get back to this point then. Okay. Anyway, continues the Gemara. Who Talmid? There was a certain Talmid. The Oda b'chalted argues could have shimon. He was in Charter de Argiz, which is the name of a place in Babel. Rashi actually brings from a tshuva from the Gaonim. The reason why the place is called that is there was a fellow named Argiz who built this city. There was a magician, a Goyish magician, who built the city. His name was Argiz. So they named the city after him, Charter of Argiz. Anyway, Rashi mentions that a couple of the Chachamim later on lived there. Rav Hamnuna lived there and is buried over there. Anyway, so there was a Talmud who was in the city of Charta d'Argiz, and he paskened over there, like Rav Shimon, the narrower definition of Mukta. Shamte Rav Hamnuna. So Rav Hamnuna, who, as we just said, lived in the city, put this Talmud in Chelen. So the question is, why? What do you mean? We hold like Rav Shimon. What's wrong with what this Talmud did? The answer is ba'asre de rab malva. That's fine. But nevertheless, chauta de argiz is in the area of Bavel, which was under Rav's control. You have, we know that there were the two great yeshivas in Bavel, in Soran and Pompidissa. And so you had, there was the area, so there was the area in and around Surah, where they followed Rav's Piske Halacha, and there was the area in and around the Haudah, where they followed Shmuel's Piske Halacha. Chauta to Argiz is in the area near Surah. So therefore, that's Rav's area. So therefore, this Talmud should not have done that. He should not have passed him like Rav Shimon when Rav holds like Rav Yehuda, because he's in the area where Rav's Piske Halacha holds sway. And that's why Rav Hamnuna put him in Chayim.
This was after Rav was passed away?
Probably. I mean, Rav Hamnuna is a Talmud of Rav, yeah. So, but the point is that nevertheless, in that area, that it's sort of like you have nowadays, is when you have, for example, you have Pesachim of the, you have, for example, Piske Halacha of the Mechaber versus the Ramah, let's say, a general Sfardim versus Ashkenazim. So each place has its own, each place, they follow their own Piske Halacha, and they follow their own Minhagim, and it's not appropriate to go there and start passing Halacha the other way.
Mm-hmm.
You have, by the way, on the positive side, you have a story involving the Talmud of the Tzemach Tzedek, who had some kind of lung disease, where if you have such a thing in an animal, the Mechaber holds that the animal is kosher, and the Ramah holds Tereif. So this Chassid said, his name is Rabbi Leo Yosef of Driven, he said, in that case, I'm going to move to Eretz Yisrael, because here in Poland or Russia or whatever, wherever it was that he lived, we follow the Ramah. According to that, then I'm going to be Tereif. I'm not going to live through this. But if I move to Eretz Yisrael, where they pass him like the Mechaber, then the nature follows what the Torah says. So if there, the Pesach Halacha is like the Beis Yosef, then I also will recover. And sure enough, he moved to Eretz Yisrael and lived there more than 20 years more. Okay. Anyway, getting back to the Gemara over here. Another example where we have two different Piske Halacha is, we're going to refer briefly to something that we're going to learn about in the 16th Perek of Our Masechta. The 16th Perek talks about, most of it talks about the case where a fire breaks out in a house on Shabbos, Chas V'Shalom. Now, if it's a matter of Pikuach Nefesh, then yeah, you put out the fire, or you call the fire department or whatever. But if it's not a matter of Pikuach Nefesh, if everybody can get out of the house safely, then, of course, you're not allowed to put out the fire on Shabbos. The Chachamim also were concerned that if you're allowed to just save whatever you want from the house, then you're going to forget in the haste that you're in such a hurry to get everything out of the house, you're going to forget altogether that it's Shabbos and put out the fire. Therefore, the Chachamim imposed rules of how much you're allowed to take out of the house. In particular, the Mishnah says over there, you're allowed to, when it comes to food, you're allowed to take out into the nearby chotzer or whatever, only 3 meals worth of food, because for the 3 meals of Shabbos. But you have a case over there, you have different cases over there where you're allowed to take out more. So the Gemara says, Hani Tre Talmidi, so there were two Talmidim, Chad Maso B'Chad Mona, one of them, when there was a fire, he would gather as much as possible into one big container and then take it out into another chotzer, which, according to one opinion over there, is allowed, because if the container is big enough to hold, even the Mishnah says over there, 100 meals, then you're allowed to, because you're not doing any extra tircha to carry on Shabbos, because you're only carrying one container. The other one said that what you could do is, the other Talmud said or did, that he would save in 4 or 5 containers. So what he would do is he would gather up food into 4 or 5 different containers. Then Rashi says he would pour all of those into one big container and then take it all at once. The Kamisigi reported to Rabbi Bar Zav and Rav Huna. So these two Talmudim are having the same machlokas as Rabbi Bar Zav and Rav Huna in the 16th Perek, later on, who discussed the question, when we say in the Mishnah over there that you're allowed to save, for example, a big basket of bread, even if there's enough bread in it for 100 sodas, does it mean only if you have all the bread is in there in the first place, or does it mean even if you're going to assemble some different containers together and put it all into that one big container? Tosfos over here learned differently, that the Arba B'Chomish money, that we're referring to go over and over into the same chotzer. Because Tosfos says that's the actual machlokas over there. Are you allowed to, when you're taking it over and over again to the same chotzer, are you allowed to take more than one container? Again, here is not the main place for it. The Gemara is just bringing it here incidentally because we have examples where we have this Talmud passed in like Paskin like the Shimon where he wasn't supposed to. So the Gemara is bringing in another example where Talmud and Paskin, one way or another, like two different opinions of Amoraim. But the main discussion of that topic of saving things from a fire will be in the 16th Perek, says the Shem. So in about 3.5 months. Okay. So now the Mishnah says, Ein solen boser botzel uveitza. You're not allowed to roast before Shabbos meat or onions or eggs. Elikadeshi solen uveitza, unless there's enough time before Shabbos for them to get roasted. So we discussed that before. We discussed that on your Chesed and Beis. So we said actually that we had two versions of a machlokes between of Ashi and of Yemi and Midifki. Is it that you're always allowed to in an oven? It's only also that you're always allowed to in an oven because we're not worried that you're going to stir the coals. It's only also if you're doing it directly on top of the coals. Or is it that it would be also under some circumstances in an oven unless the oven was sealed shut or unless the meat was the kind of meat, as we said then, and as we're going to say soon in the Gemara, that is soft and is going to be damaged by the air coming in if you open up the oven. Okay. So this both that Shammai and Gesil agree to the basic halacha, because as we said before, there's a problem, Shemi Yechata v'gacholim, you might stir up the coals to make the food cook faster. Continues the Mishnah, Ein noisin pas latanarim hashecha, you're not allowed to put bread into an oven to bake right before Shabbos begins, v'loi charora al gabi gacholim, or a cake to put it directly on top of the coals, not really a cake, more like a type of bread that they would bake directly on the coals, sort of like a pizza or something. So you're not allowed to do that. Unless there's enough time for the surface of it to become brown, to develop a crust before Shabbos begins. Rabbi Yezah says there has to be enough time for the bottom of it to become brown and form a crust. So we'll see in the Gemara, we'll discuss in the Gemara whether Rabbi Yezah is being makel against the Tanakhama or whether he's being machmer. We'll get that. Continues the Mishnah. Mishalshon is a Pesach Tanarim Chashecha. Now, on the other hand, you are allowed to lower the Korban Pesach into the oven to be roasted as Shabbos is beginning, even though it's not finished, even though it's not going to finish roasting and it's not even going to get to Michael Ben Rasoi before Shabbos begins. You're allowed to, for reasons that were because the Gemara is going to say, because Bnei Chavurah is risen hain, because you have the members of the group. Remember, the Korban Pesach is eaten by a group that has to pre-register together. So there's risen. They're careful and they'll remind each other not to stir the coal to make it roast faster. So you're allowed to do that. You're also allowed to right before Shabbos start the fire in the fire of the Beis Hamor in the fire of the Beis Hamorked. The Beis Hamorked is a chamber that was in the Beis Mikdash. They kept a fire burning all the time there. Rashi says the purpose of that fire was to keep the Kohanim warm because the Kohanim walk around barefoot. They do that, they don't have there's no shoes or socks among the Bignei Kohanah, and the floor is marble, so they easily get cold. So therefore, they would go sometimes and warm themselves up by this fire. So you're allowed to start that fire before Shabbos, right before Shabbos, and we're not worried again that you're going to try to stir it up and make it burn better on Shabbos. According to the Rambam, the purpose of this fire of the Beis Hamikdash was a little bit different. It was meant to be that if the fire on the Mizbeach ever goes out, then they would relight it from this one. Anyway, so you're allowed to light that fire right before Shabbos, and we're not worried that you're going to stir the coals, because as the Gemara is going to say, Kohanim's risen in, the Kohanim are careful, and they're not going to stir up the coals on Shabbos. And also, actually, we're going to see in the Gemara another thing about it as well. Over Gvulin, but anywhere else outside the Beis Mikdash, if you're lighting a fire right before Shabbos, then you have to light enough today shekecha ur b'rubay. The fire has to catch onto most of it before Shabbos in order for you to be able to light it. Otherwise, if it doesn't catch onto the most of it, and we'll see in the Gemara what we mean by most of it, then you're not allowed to do that before Shabbos, because then the Chachamim are concerned that you're going to try to stir it up and move things around or whatever in order to make it burn better. Rabbi Yehuda, under the Pechamin, Kol Shehu, Rabbi Yehuda says, when it comes to a fire of charcoal, then even if only a little bit of it catches before Shabbos, then it's allowed, because then it will continue, then it's definitely going to continue catching, then you don't have to stir it up. It's going to, one coal is going to catch on another, and therefore it's allowed. You have a machlokes rishonim, whether the halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda or not. You have the tour brings Rabbeinu Yeruchim brings that you're allowed to, that the halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda. You have the Rambam who says that not the halacha is like the Chachamim, and therefore, so if you have a fire or charcoal, then you'd have a machloek at the poskim whether you're allowed to start it just a little bit before Shabbos, and that's good enough. So the Gemara asks, the Kama, when we say that food has to be roasted before Shabbos in order for it to be allowed to put into the oven before Shabbos, how roasted does it have to get? Amar Rav Elazar, Amar Rav Kadeshi, Tzolim, Ebo'odion, Kamaycho, Ben Rusoi. It has to be that you put it into the oven long enough before Shabbos that the food is going to be roasted to the extent of Maycho, Ben Rusoi. Ben Rusoi was a robber, so he used to always be on the run. He was always on the run, so when he cooked his food, he would cook it and eat it very quickly. He wouldn't wait for it to be completely cooked. Once it was partially cooked to a certain extent, he would already eat it. So therefore, that's considered to be the minimum amount that it has to be cooked or roasted in order for it to be considered cooked as far as the halachas of Shabbos and as far as various other halachas that we're going to say now in the Gemara. How much is Michael Bender's story? Rashi over here says that's one-third cooked. The Rambam says that it's one-half cooked.
Why does the Gemara have to talk about halacha being established in the name of a robber? I mean, is that something that is acceptable? Why don't we just say a third cooked, a half cooked, whatever it is?
It's a good question. It could be that the Gemara just wants to establish that this is something that is minimally edible. Because we see that there was actually a fellow named Ben Rusoi who actually ate his food that way. So it could be it has something to do with that. Just in order to demonstrate that somebody actually ate it that way. I think I remember seeing something. I didn't find it just now, but I think I remember seeing something along the lines of that this Ben Rusoi has a certain tzchus. We find in one place in destroying Avodah Zarah or something, and therefore, like, he had this tzchus that his name gets attached to this halacha. Not sure about that, though. All right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Itmar Nami, we said also, Amun of Asi, Amun of Rechnan, Kol Shehu K'maychol Ben Rusoi, Ein Ben Mishum B'shulei Nachri, Mishum B'shulei Nachri. And here's another din that refers to Michael Ben Rusoi. Once food is cooked to the extent of Michael Ben Rusoi, then there's no problem of Bishul Akum with it anymore. So in other words, if a Jew cooked that food to this extent, one-third or one-half, then even if he leaves it alone and a Goy does the rest of the cooking, there's no problem of Bishul Akum. Because again, once it reached this point, then already it's minimally edible, and therefore that's good enough. Mm-hmm. Tanya, and we learn in a Braisa, a third din in this connection, Chananya.
That's what we apply in the bakeries, that we start the fire.
Yeah, but bread, that's different, yeah. The bakery is pasakum, that's something else. But yeah. Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, a Chananya, a third din in this connection, kosher kamaifo bendrisoi, whenever food is already cooked or roasted or whatever, to the extent of maifo bendrisoi, mutu lahashoyse, agabe kira, you're allowed to leave it on the stove when Shabbos begins, the apopisha ain grufo ktuma, even if the coals have not been swept out of the oven or covered with ashes. We're going to learn in the third parak. We're going to learn the details in the third parak about the beginning of Shehiya, about when you're allowed to leave food on the stove before Shabbos and when not. Because again, you have a concern if you leave food on the stove, there's a concern that you might stir up the coals in order to make it stay hotter. So therefore, so you have dinim about that, which we're going to talk about extensively in the third parak, says the Shem. So Chananya is saying that if the food is already at Michael Ben Rusoi, then you don't have a problem with that. Then you're allowed to leave it on the stove, even if you didn't sweep out the coals or even if you didn't cover them with ashes. Because again, once it's cooked for Michael Ben Rusoi, then it's the minimum amount that you're able, it's the minimum amount that it's already edible, and therefore you're allowed to do that. Whether the halacha is like Chananya or not, we'll get to that in the third paragraph. Okay. Continues the Mishnah. We said that you're not allowed to put bread to bake in the oven unless, we said, the Tanakhama had said, unless the face of it formed a crust before Shabbos. And Rabbi Eliezer said the underside of it. So, first of all, we have to ask, what does Rabbi Eliezer mean when he says the bottom? Now, you have to remember, the ovens in those days were made sort of like an inverted cup. Imagine like you take, for example, like a plastic cup or something, which is narrower on the bottom than on the top. If you flip it over, if you imagine it flipped over and with the bottom cut off, then that's pretty much what their ovens looked like in those days. They were shaped sort of like a cone, narrower on the top, wider on the bottom. And then you would stick, so to bake bread, the normal way of baking bread was you would stick the bread to the side of the oven. So therefore, in effect, the bread is sort of hanging in the oven kind of upside down. So now the question becomes, when Rabbi Eliezer says that you have to have the bottom of it form the crust, what does he mean by the bottom? Does the bottom mean the side that's closer to the wall of the oven? Or maybe the bottom means the one that's lower down, meaning the one that's closer to the fire. Because again, the bread is sort of hanging upside down. Toshma, well, we have a braiser, Rabbi Eliezer, and the Kadesh Yukumo Paneh Amdu Broken Batano. Rabbi Eliezer says that you require that the side that's stuck to the oven is the one that forms a crust. Now Rashi learns, therefore, that it means that Rabbi Eliezer is machmir over the Chachamim, because the Chachamim are saying that, because Rashi learns that when you bake bread in that way, when you bake bread in that kind of oven, which side is going to form a crust first? The side that's facing the fire. Because it's facing the fire, therefore it's going to turn brown and crust over first. So the Tanakhama then would be makel and say that that's enough. Rabbi Eliezer would be machmir and say you need a later stage. You need where it actually you need where the part that's stuck to the oven browns first. Tosfos asks on that based on Yerushalmi that says the other way around. Rabbi Eliezer seems to be makel, not machmir. So therefore Tosfos learns the other way around, that the side that's touching the oven is more likely to brown first. The Pnei Yeshua discusses in order to defend Rashi that maybe what it is is the Chachamim would say that when we say Kadesh Yishrim or Paneha would be that all the surfaces of it have to become brown first, whereas Rabbi Eliezer would say only some of the surfaces. Okay. So that's it. So you have this machlokas between Rabbi Eliezer and the Chacham, and how much of it has to be baked in order to be able to put it into the oven before Shabbos. So in the case of bread, you have the same machlokas that we have here in the Mishnah. You have a machlokas Rishonim who the halacha is like. And so in Shulchan Aruch it says that if only the side that's touching the oven, it brown first, and b'dievet you're going to be able to eat that bread on Shabbos. But l'chatchila you shouldn't put it in unless there's time for the other side of it to brown first. Okay. We said in the Mishnah, Mishal Shalom HaPesach, we say you're allowed to lower the Pesach. Remember, they roasted the Korban Pesach. They'd take the sheep or the goat that you use for the Korban Pesach and put it on a spit, put it on a stick that runs from one end to the other, and lower it into the oven to roast it on the stick. So we said you're allowed to put it into the oven right before Shabbos. My time of Mishnah Bnei Chabura is Rizin Hain. Because we say the Bnei Chabura, the members of the group who are going to be eating the Korban Pesach, are Zoriz, they're careful, and they're going to remind each other to not do anything with the coals on Shabbos. Okay. So the question is, Holav Tachi Loi. So are you telling me if there's no Bnei Chabura, then you wouldn't be allowed to do that? V'ha'amamar, we learned before on Daf Yud Ches on the days, we said Gadya ben Shorik ben Le Shorik Shaper Dami. We said there, okay, we had actually two versions of the Machlokas. But we said there, according to both versions, that if you have meat of a young animal, like a goat, which the Korban Pesach is always a young animal, because it has to be a sheep or a goat that's within a year, or that's less than a year old. And we said over there, meat from a tender animal like that, we said you're allowed to put it into roast. Whether the oven is sealed shut or not, because again, if you open up the oven, then it's going to damage the meat, because the cold air is going to make it harden. So therefore, so for that reason alone, you should be allowed to put the Korban Pesach into roast before Shabbos, because it's a young animal. The answer is Hosam Mintach Tochal and Mintach. The difference is that in that case, it's a case on Yud Ches Amud Beis, when we said it's mutter, we're talking about when the meat was cut up. There you have on pieces of meat. Then the air would damage it if you opened up the oven in the middle of the roasting. As opposed to over here, you're talking about a whole animal being roasted together, because that's how they roasted the Korban Pesach, the whole thing together. So therefore, even if it's soft meat, you'd still have that the air is not going to damage it so much if you open the oven on Shabbos, and therefore the only heter for it is because you have the Bnei Chabura there.
We never made that distinction in the case over there, whether it's Mintzach or not.
That's the point. I mentioned over there that we're going to revisit this on Kof on the Bay, because normally when you're roasting meat, you don't usually roast the whole animal together. Usually when you're roasting, in fact, you have a distinction. The Gemara makes like that in Cholin as well. You have a Mishnah in Cholin where Rabbi Horda says that when you're shechting a bird, you also have to shecht the viridin. You also have to cut the viridin, the arteries or the veins or whatever it is that are in the neck in order for the blood to drain out. And the Gemara says over there that Rabbi Horda is saying that specifically by a bird, because birds are often roasted whole, as opposed to by animals, he doesn't require it, because anyway, you're going to be cutting up the animal usually before you roast it or cook it. And therefore, anyway, the blood is going to be able to drain out. So we see that animals are not usually roasted whole, and therefore the Gemara over there didn't have to mention this consideration about it being whole, but all Gemara is mentioning it. Then we said, we said the next thing in the Mishnah was, we said that you're allowed to light the fire in the Beit HaMoked right before Shabbos, and we're not worried that they're going to stir it up on Shabbos. So they're going to ask, Menahani Mili, where do we know this from? Now, I mean, the whole thing is the Rabbanon. What do we mean, Menahani Mili? So the Pnei Yeshua has a long explanation where the gist of it is that even though it's true, this din of not lighting fires right before Shabbos is only the Rabbanon, because you might stir up the coals, but nevertheless, the point is, he explains that the Gemara wants to establish that when it comes to the fire of the Beit HaMoked, even if they were to light it on Shabbos itself, it wouldn't be an Isser Daraita, but for reasons that the Gemara is going to explain now. Therefore, once there's no Isser in doing it, even on Shabbos, then the Chachamim don't have a problem with them doing it right before Shabbos, as opposed to elsewhere in the world, where you're not allowed to light a fire on Shabbos, except for Pekuach Nefesh, then the Chachamim are going to impose a rule that says that you can't light it before Shabbos either, unless it has enough time to catch on, where it'll keep on going on its own. The Pasuk says, you're not allowed to burn a fire in any of your dwellings, which means it means that you're not allowed to light a fire or extend a fire or whatever anywhere in your dwellings, meaning anywhere else in the world. But the implication is that when it comes to the Beit HaMoked, which is part of the Beit HaMikdash, then you are allowed to light that fire on, you are allowed to have that fire burn on Shabbos. By the way, there is the Rebbe once pointed out in the Sicha a lesson from this in Avodah, that the point is that we're saying on Shabbos, where we're supposed to be divorced from everything involving the world, then and also a Talmid Chacham was called Shabbos, and even during the week he should be more into Torah and less into the things of the world. Fire represents excitement, heat, or whatever, like we have by Makas Dam, where the point is that the Mitzrayim had this inappropriate heat and excitement about things of Klippa, and Hashem had to break them about by turning it, or the other way around, where they had a coldness to Kedusha, and therefore Hashem had to break that by turning it into warm blood. So therefore, the idea is, on Shabbos, you have no business getting involved, getting hot and getting excited and whatever about things in your houses, about things in Olam Hazeh, only when it comes to things of Kedusha, the Beit HaMikdash. Anyway, the point is that we're saying so the Beit HaMoked fire, it's fine to have it burning on Shabbos, therefore you're allowed to start it right before Shabbos. Maski for Rav Chista, however, Rav Chista asks on that, if you're going to say that posik means that you're allowed to burn the fire on Shabbos, after the Shabbos Nami, then the din should apply that even on Shabbos itself they're allowed to light the fire. Now, the fact is, even if, fine, we're going to say, like the Pnei Yeshua says, that maybe they're not over on an Isser Daraita if we do, but still, we know that the Mishnah is not telling us that we can actually light the fire in the Beit HaMoked on Shabbos, just that we can start it right before Shabbos and not worry about that it might not catch before Shabbos. Ela, Amar Rav Chista, so Rav Chista says, no. Kro, ki osa la mishri evorim ukdorim. No, the Pasuk is actually coming to tell us a different din. That, when you have fat and pieces of the carbonus that are left over, that you're allowed to burn them throughout the night, even on Shabbos. That's what we learned from Loisavaru Eshvachol Mishvetechem, that anywhere else in the world you're not allowed to burn things on Shabbos, but when it comes to the Beit HaMikdash, you're allowed to burn the leftover pieces of the carbonus on the Mizbeach.
But you're not still supposed to start a fire on the Mizbeach on Shabbos?
Start the fire in the Beit HaMoked on Shabbos, you would not be allowed to do. And the fire on the Mizbeach has to be kept burning all the time anyway. So if they see it go out, then they have to relight it. Then they relight it from the Beit HaMoked. But fine, that's not lighting a new fire. That's taking fire from one place and bringing it to another, which is the kind of thing that's mutar on Yom Tov. So on Shabbos, yeah, you do that because you have a mitzvah not to let the fire on the mizbeach go out. But here we're talking about as far as burning things that we're saying. Rav Chisda is saying the pasuk is not talking about what our Mishnah was mentioning about the fire in the Beit HaMikdash at all. It's talking about the fact that you're allowed to burn the leftover pieces of the korbanos on the mizbeach. As far as our Mishnah, when it's saying that you're allowed to start the fire in the Beit HaMikdash, the reason is because the Kohanim is using it. Because the reason is because the Kohanim are careful, and they're going to be careful with the, and they're not going to actually stir up the coals or move things around in the fire to get it to burn properly on Shabbos.
Does that mean if on Shabbos, they're running out of wood or coal, they're allowed to add new wood and new coal on Shabbos?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, actually, you have one of the avoiders in the Beis Hamikdash is that every morning and every afternoon during the Korban Tomid Shel Shachar and during the Korban Tomid Shel Ben HaBayim, the Kohanim are supposed to add, there's actually a mitzvah for them to add 2 logs of wood to the fire on the Mizbeach. So yeah, they do that on Shabbos as well, the same way as they do all the other avoiders of the Korbanos on Shabbos as well.
Okay.
But yes, if it were to happen that they notice on Shabbos the fire is going out, then yeah, that's the point. They would take, as the Rambam says, they would take coals from the fire in the Beis HaMikdash and put them on the Mizbeach and use that to relight the fire. But yeah, I mean, also they have every morning they would set up a wood pile on the Mizbeach. So yeah, again, they do that Shabbos as well. Tosfos actually discusses over here, it's not so simple as far as these Evarim Mukhdarim, because because the ones that are left over from the weekdays, you're actually not allowed to burn on Shabbos. We're actually going to learn that in the next parak. If we're talking about the ones that are from the korbanos that are actually brought on Shabbos themselves, then there's not really much of a chiddush in that, because then obviously it's part of a korban of Shabbos. So Tosfos says, okay, we're talking about ones that are left over from the weekday, but the fire had already burnt them mostly on the weekday, and then you would be allowed to continue burning them on Shabbos. So Tosfos gets into a bit of a long discussion about the pros and cons of that. Right. Anyway, we said in the Mishnah over Gulim Kadesh Techos Kula, we said when it comes outside of this Mishnah, if you want to light a fire before Shabbos, it has to be lit enough that most of it has caught on before Shabbos. In order that way, once most of it is caught on, then you're not going to move things around to get it to burn better because now it's already continuing on its own. So when we said Ruban, my Ruban, what do we mean by the majority? Omer Rav, Roy Kol Echad V'Echad. Rav says it means the majority of every individual piece. So every individual piece of wood that's in that fire has to be mostly on fire in order for you to be able to do that before Shabbos. Shmuel says it doesn't necessarily have to be that much. Today, Shlo Yomer just has to be burning to the extent that people don't have to say, Hovi Eitzim Menaneach Haseim. Let's go get pieces of wood to put underneath them to keep the fire going. In other words, according to Shmuel, it doesn't have to be caught on quite so much. As Rav is saying, once the fire is self-sustaining and you don't have to be putting in wood or newspaper or whatever to get it to catch, then you're good enough. So the Gemara says, Tonin of Chia L'Sayuri L'Shmuel, Rav Chia taught a b'raisa which supports what Shmuel says. The b'raisa says, "Kadesh shetoheh shall have its oila me'eleha," that it has to be enough that the flame is rising on its own. "V'lo shetoheh shall have its oila ajei davar acher," not that the flame is rising only when you're putting in something else. So what does that mean? Rashi brings from one of his rebbeim, Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi, that the original statement that Rav Chia is talking about in this brisa is regarding lighting the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash. So when it says b'haloscha es haneres, that it has to be lighted ad shetesh shel heves olam eileh, so the flame is rising on its own, and therefore the same thing over here, then that would be considered that the fire has already been lit. Rashi has a couple of problems with that. So Rashi brings from his other rebbeim that actually the Braisa is referring to the topic that we're talking about in the Gemara over here about a bonfire, that we're talking about how much of the fire has to be lit. So Rabbi's Braisa is saying that as long as once the fire is shetei shel heves olam eileh, the flame is rising on its own, meaning that you don't have to tend to it anymore, then already it's considered lit enough that is good before Shabbos, and therefore that's exactly what Shmuel is saying. So that's the halacha, is that once you have shal heves olam eileha, then usually when we have a machloikas in dinei iser v'heter, usually when we have Rav versus Shmuel, usually the halacha is like Rav. But here, because we have Rav Chia's braisa in support of Shmuel, then the halacha is like Shmuel. Okay. What about eitz yichid? What about if you're making a fire with one individual log of wood? How much of that log has to be on fire before Shabbos for it to be allowed? Rav, whoever has that in the background, if you don't mind muting. So Rav Omer Roiv Oivyoi. So Rav says that you need to have the majority of the thickness of the log is on fire, meaning that the fire has to have penetrated at least 51% of the way through the thickness of the log. Amri lo b'roiv hakeifei. Others say it has to be the majority of the circumference of the outside of the log has to be on fire. Amar Papa. So the Papa says, since we have two different versions of what Rav says, and we're not sure which one is correct, hilchach b'inan roiv ovyoi b'inan roiv hakeifei. Therefore, in order for that to be mutter, we would need that actually you have both. That before Shabbos begins, the log, again, we're talking about when there's one single log of wood in the fire, you would have to have that there enough of it is on fire that both most of its thickness and most of its diameter is on, not diameter, most of its thickness and most of its circumference is on fire before Shabbos. Okay, this is actually Masloitis Tanoim. We learn in the Braise, Reb Chiya Omer, Kadesh Yishochet Ta'et Memelachas Oman. Reb Chiya says that at what point is the fire doing well enough that you're allowed to have started it before Shabbos is once the wood is ruined and can't be used by a craftsman to make something anymore. So that would be Reb Oye, that would be most of the thickness. Once most of the thickness is burnt, then an Oman, a craftsman, wouldn't be able to take it and use it to make a wooden keli out of or something. Rav Yehuda ben Beseira and the Kadesh Terechaz Ais Mishnei Tzadin. Rav Yehuda ben Beseira says it has to be that the fire is caught on to the two sides of it, which is Roiv HaKeifei, which is most of the circumference. Once you have the fire has caught on to both of the two outsides, then that's already 51% of the circumference. And Alpha Pishay and Raya Ladaber, even though we don't have a solid proof for this, that once a log is set on fire, to that extent, then it's enough. Zeicha l'gavur, but we have a zeicha for it. We have a hint for it in a pasuk. You have a pasuk in Yechezkel. You have a short mashal over there where the pasuk compares the navi compares the Jewish people to a grapevine that's not producing grapes. Like this, Hashem intended that the Jewish people should be learning Torah and doing mitzvahs, and in Yechezkel's times they're not doing that. It's a few years before the Churban. So he gives a mashal over there about if you have a grapevine where the wood itself is not even to begin with usable for much work because it's very weak because the branches are very thin and weak. And then if you have on top of that such a vine is burnt at both ends, then you're not going to be able to do anything useful with it. So the pasuk says it's shnei ktzeis of achol ha'esh, the two ends of it were consumed by the fire, the toichei nachar, and the inside of it is dried up. Would it be usable for any kind of work? Obviously not. And the same way, the Navi is saying, like, you Jewish people, not only you're not doing what you're supposed to in the first place, but like this, you already have, half of you have gone into Golos already, because this is after Golos Yechonia. What makes you think that you're going to be successful in the world if you don't do tshuva and become what you're supposed to be doing? So we see a hint from this pasuk. So we see a hint from this pasuk that once both sides have been burnt, then the inside already is dried up. It's not a solid proof, the Tosfos says, because after all, here we're talking in the pasuk, first of all, it's only a mashal, but second of all, in the pasuk, it's talking about a grapevine, and a grapevine has much narrower and thinner branches than most other kinds of trees. But still, it's a zecher for this idea that once the two ends have been burnt, then it's useless to do anything more with it. And therefore, the point is that the inside and that the inside is burnt up, and therefore, at that point, it's going to catch on its own.
And that's the halacha?
So the halacha is, as Rav Papa has said, that you need roiv oivye v'roiv hakeifei. Given that we said we had two versions of what Rav said, and we weren't sure which one is correct, then Rav Papa had said we need roiv oivye and roiv hakeifei, and that's the halacha. If you have a fire that you're making with one single log, then you have to have, if you're going to do it before Shabbos, you have to do it with enough time before Shabbos that both the majority of the circumference of the outside of it and the majority of the inside of the log have caught on fire before Shabbos. Otherwise, you can't do it. Okay. In this connection, also, you have a pasuk in Sefer Yirmiyah. Now, you have like this. The pasuk describes the story over there, how Yirmiyah wrote a book of his nevuah. Rashi explains over there, based on the Gemara, that it was actually Sefer Eicha. Hashem told Yirmiyah to write it. This is about 17 years before the Churban, but Hashem told Yirmiyah to write out in advance Sefer Eicha, the Megillas Eicha, with all of its prediction, with all of its mourning and then baklogging zich and everything over what's going to happen during the Churban, with the idea being that this way maybe Jehoiakim, who was the king at that time, and his officers will hear it and realize that things are serious and they better do tshuva. So the pasuk describes over there how Yirmiyah sends the sefer with his Talmud Baruch ben Neriah to be read in front of Jehoiakim, and the pasuk describes how Jehoiakim, being a rasha, didn't want to listen, and he took the whole thing and cut it up and threw it into the fire. So the pasuk says that the och lefon of mevoy eres. The pasuk mentions that the och was burning in front of Jehoiakim. So the simple meaning of och, the Mephoshim explained on the pasuk, means like a fireplace or a brazier or something. The pasuk describes it was during the winter time. It was during Kislev, so it was cold. So they had a fire burning. But the Gemara is bothered by why is it called och? My och. Why is a fire like that called och? So Amar Rav Achvona. Rav says it refers to a fire made out of arava branches. Aravas are called achvana because they grow many arava trees grow together. In fact, in a number of places in the Chassidus, it talks about when we have the Dalet Minyan, each of the Dalet Minyan is a symbol of Avos Yisrael in one way or another. In the case of the Aravas, it's based on what the Gemara is saying over here, the fact that many arava trees grow together, which is a symbol of Achdus. So therefore, so Rav says the pasuk, the word ha'och in the pasuk refers to our rabbis which grow together. Shmuel says it doesn't necessarily mean arava branches, willow branches. It just means branches where one of them lights on fire from another. So in fact, the Gemara says, "Ahuda amalahu man boy achvana." One time there was a person going around and calling out for sale, "Who wants to buy achvana?" And nobody knew what achvana is, ishtakach arvosa, but then they checked, they looked and to see what he has for sale, and they found he's selling arava branches. So we see that arava branches are called achvana. Okay. Continues the Gemara. Getting back to the matter of fires that you're starting before Shabbos, where how much of the fire has to be burning before Shabbos, as we said, in order for it to be allowed. Amar Rav Huna, konin ein srichin roi. So Rav Huna says, if you're making a fire out of sticks, or not a konim actually is more like bamboo or other such reeds like that, then you don't require roiv because they easily catch on fire, because once they catch on fire, they continue burning on their own. You're not going to need to move them around in order to get the fire to stay. On the other hand, ogdan, but Rav Huna says, if you bundle the reeds together, srich and roiv, then you do require roiv because now the fire can't easily get between them because they're bundled together. Therefore, you need that roiv of them is on fire before Shabbos. Similarly, if you're making a fire using pits or seeds of dates or other such fruits, if you're making a fire out of those, again, ein tzrichin roiv, you don't require that roiv of it is on fire before Shabbos for the same reason, because they easily, once they're on fire, they stay on fire. Nothing, the choslois, but if you took these date pits and put them into containers Rashi describes that are made out of lulav leaves, so they tie together lulav leaves to make sort of like you have the keshlach that you have there that the belt uses for the hadassim and arabis and sukkahs. So you make such things, you weave together such little baskets like that out of lulav leaves, and you put the seeds in there, then srich and roiv, then you require roiv for the same reason, because the fire can't easily get to it, because it's more like one solid thing, and therefore you need most of it to be on fire before Shabbos. However, maskif for Rav Chista says, I have a problem with that. Adrabah, ifchavisabra. On the contrary, logic should dictate the other way around. Tanim nivadron, if you have individual reeds and they're not tied together, then they easily scatter. So therefore, you're going to want to move them together in order to make the fire burn better. So on the other hand, if you have them bound together, then they don't come apart as easily, and therefore you don't have reason to move them around. Therefore, it's more likely that the fire will catch on to all of them once it starts on even some of them. Similarly, garin in mevadron. Similarly, he says individual seeds or individual picks easily fall away from each other, so you have the same thing. One of them might be on fire, but it's not necessarily going to light the next one on fire unless you move them together, and you're not allowed to do that on Shabbos. Nothing but choslos loyevadron. But if you put them in these baskets made out of lulav leaves, then they don't scatter. So therefore, it's more likely that when one of them catches on fire, the rest of them will. So according to Rav Chista, it would be exactly the other way around, exactly the opposite of what Rav Huna is saying. If they are tied together, you wouldn't need, or they're in these containers, you wouldn't need roiv, and if they're separate, then you would need roiv. So this one says Ishmar Nami. We have actually another statement of Amaroyim about that. Amar of Pahana, Konim Sha'ogdon Srichin Roiv, when it comes to sticks, when it comes to sticks or reeds or whatever, then if they're tied together, then you require Roiv, because, like Rav Huna says, because otherwise the fire doesn't get between them well. As far as the problem that Rav Chisda said, that they may fall away one from the other, Rashi says, since they're long and heavy, they're not likely to. Loy ogdan ein srichin roiv. On the other hand, if you didn't tie them together, then you do require roiv, like Rav Huna had said. But ga'inin, when it comes to seeds, when it comes to pits, is the other way around. Srichin roiv, when they're individual pits, you do require roiv. That part is like Rav Chisda. Nosten b'chos was ein srichin roiv. But if you put them in these containers, in these woven containers, then it doesn't require roiv, because then they'll burn very easily. Because since they're small pits, they're going to easily fall apart one from the other unless you have them in a container like that. So according to Rashi's Girsa, which is how we have it in front of us in the Gemara, it means Rav Kahana is taking a middle ground between Rav Huna and Rav Chisda. Rav Huna had said that both of them, both when it comes to reeds and when it comes to pits, both of them, you don't need roiv when they're separate, but you do need roiv when they're tied together. Rav Chisda said exactly the opposite. So according to Rashi, Rav Kahana is splitting the difference and saying that Rav Kahana is splitting the difference and saying that there's a difference between reeds and pits in that case. Now you have different gersos among the Rishonim over here. You have the Rif and the Rambam have a gersa that in all cases actually you need them to be tied together in order. You need them to be tied together or bundled together in order for it to be allowed to start. So in other words, the halacha would be completely like. So according to them, the halacha would be completely like Rav Chisda. Let me see. I may have that backwards. Let me see a second. The other way around. If they're separate, the halacha in Shulchan Aruch is that if it actually brings both opinions, but the Alter Rebbe passed things like the Rif and the Rambam and whatever, because they're the majority, which is that when it comes to sticks or seeds, either way, if they're separate, then it's allowed. If they're bundled together, then you would have to have most of it had to have caught on fire before Shabbos, meaning completely like Rav Huna. As opposed to the Rosh's Girsa is the other way around, that the halacha would be completely like that Rav Kahana would be saying the halacha is completely like Rav Chisda. And again, Rashi learns that Rav Kahana is sort of spoiling the difference. Okay. Rabbi Yosef taught a braisa in this connection. The primary halacha is like the Rif and the Rambam Girsa of our Gemara, that Rav Kahana is saying exactly the same thing as Rav Huna, that when it comes both to reeds and to pits, in both cases if they're not bundled together, then it's enough if any one of them is caught on fire, because all the other ones will eventually catch from it. And if they're bundled together, then you need the majority of it to be on fire before Shabbos. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are four kinds of fires that you don't need a roiv of them to be lit before Shabbos, because they're easily going to catch on fire by themselves. So zefes, number one, if you have a fire made with tar, or maybe it doesn't mean tar itself, it may mean the Oruch HaShochan wants to say that it means maybe like sticks of wood that are dipped in tar or whatever. So those catch on fire very easily. Vishal gofris, or of sulfur, same idea. Vishal gvina, the third one is gvina. Gvina is cheese, but there's a girsa over here that Rishonim have, but the Rif have, not cheese, who makes a fire out of cheese, but rather kiro, which is wax. And number four, vishal revav, number four is of grease. Revav, Rashi describes, means things like fat, oil, wax, or whatever, anything that melts like that. So those kinds of things, once you start a fire with one of those, it'll self-sustain itself very easily. Therefore, it doesn't matter if even only a small amount of the fire, if only a small amount of it is on fire before Shabbos. Mm-hmm. Amr Rav Yechanan, so Rav Yechanan says further in this connection, Eitzim shal bavel ein tzrichin roiv. The kind of wood that they use in bavel doesn't require roiv. So what does that mean? Maskei for Rav Yosef. So Rav Yosef asks on that, Mayhi. Rav Yosef lives in bavel. He knows what they use over there. So what kind of wood is Rav Yechanan talking about? Ilei masilti. Do we mean that in bavel, very often they would make wood, they would make fires out of chips of wood. They would break down the wood into small pieces, and then they would make fires of it. What do you mean? What do you mean? Why should it not require a roiv? Hashta psila oma ula. When it comes even to lighting a lamp, which is when you have a wick made out of cloth or whatever that's dipped in oil and then catches on fire very easily, and still oma ula hamadlik tzarek shiabes b'roiv hayotzei, and still ula says that when you're lighting it before Shabbos, you have to light most of the wick that's sticking out of the lamp in order to make sure that it stays lit on Shabbos. How much more so when it comes to chips of wood, where then also, if you only light a little bit of it, it's not going to be self-sustaining. You're going to end up moving the chips of wood around in order for it to burn better. So it can't be that's what Rabbi Yechanan meant. Ela, Amar Rabbi Yosef Soicha de Arza. So Rabbi Yosef says, no, what Rabbi Yechanan means when he says the wood of Bavel, he must mean a branch of a cedar tree, which they had a lot of cedar trees in Bavel. In particular, Rashi explains, as we're going to learn at the beginning of the next paragraph, that you have this sort of soft, woolly stuff between the bark and the tree, and that thing. When the branch is dry, then that stuff becomes very dry, and it makes good kindling, and it makes the wood catch on very easily. So therefore, that's what Rabbi Yechanan is saying, that with that kind of thing, when you're using a dry cedar branch, then it's enough to just throw it a little bit of it, because then this stuff under the bark, which is dried out now, will help it catch on fire very easily. Rami Ba'aba says a different explanation of what the wood of Bavel is. He says it means zaza. He says it means a kind of moth. He says it means a kind of moth, which also if you light it, like a dried moth, and you light it on fire on Shabbos, and you light it on fire, then it catches on very easily. So therefore, again, according to that, Rabbi Yechanan would be saying that would be mutter to use that kind of dried moth for a fire, and to start it right before Shabbos, because the rest of it will catch very easily. Okay. Mm-hmm. For Shabbos. So now, this second perek is actually kind of a continuation of what we were just learning. We were just talking about lighting fires before Shabbos, where a person lights a fire before Shabbos in order to, among other things, in order to have light in their house. But now we're going to talk about this. Our perek is going to talk about the mitzvah of lighting Shabbos candles. We know, besides the practical fact that you need light in your house on Shabbos, and of course in those days they would have to light lamps or candles for that purpose, separately from that, you have, besides just the practical aspects of it, you have an actual mitzvah, midrabanan. It's counted as one of the official seven mitzvahs, midrabanan, to light candles before Shabbos. Light candles or lamps for covered Shabbos. So our parak is going to be talking about that, The point is, in the first mission over here, we're going to be discussing that there are certain kinds of things that Chachamim don't want you to use, because there are certain kinds of wicks where the fire doesn't catch on easily to them. So therefore, Rashi says the problem is that then you may end up trying to adjust the flame on Shabbos in order to make it burn better. And of course, that would be also. The Rambam says the reason is, given that you have a mitzvah, midrabanan, to light Shabbos candles, if you have a wick that doesn't burn evenly, or oil that doesn't get drawn up into the wick evenly, then you're going to say, forget about it. I don't need to be in here with this light. I'll just go someplace else. And then you're not going to have the light. You're not going to have the light, and you're not going to have the mitzvah and the shalom bayis that you get from having candles lit on Shabbos. So therefore, the Chachamim made rules about what you can use for Shabbos candles and what you can't. So the Mishnah starts off. By the way, any of us who have ever been in a Nusach Ashkenaz shul should be a little bit familiar with this parak, because where we say in Kabbal Shabbos, where we say Tigavna, in Nusach Ashkenaz instead, they say this parak by Memam Likin, since it contains certain basic halachas of Shabbos.
Right.
So the Mishnah starts off, Memam Likin or Memam Likin. What kind of things are you allowed to use for wicks and for oils for Shabbos candles, and what are you not allowed to? So, ein mavlikin, you're not allowed to use as follows. Loibu lechesh, You're not allowed to use lechesh. The Gemara is going to explain. It means, like we just said, this woolly stuff that's under the bark of a cedar tree. So you could conceivably make wicks out of it, but again, such wicks don't burn evenly. So you're not allowed to use that. V'loy b'chosen. You're not allowed to use chosen, which we'll see in the Gemara two possibilities of what it is. It has something to do with flax. V'loy b'koloch, or with koloch, which is something that has to do with silk. Again, we'll see about the details in the Gemara. V'loy b'tzilas ha'idon. You're not allowed to use a wick made from idon, which is another kind of thing where you have a woolly substance under the bark of a tree, under the bark of an arava tree this time. So you're not allowed to use that. V'loy b'tzilas ha'midbar, or a wick made out of something that grows in the desert, which is a certain kind of plant that grows in the desert, where you could twist wicks out of it. You have some kind of plant that grows in the desert, maybe like yucca or something that has long skinny leaves. So you could twist them together to make a wick, but again, it doesn't really burn so well as a wick. You're also not allowed to use the green stuff on the water, which the Gemara is going to discuss what that means. That it means like barnacles or something that grow under a ship that's in the water for a long time. So all those things, even though conceivably you could make wicks out of them, in practice, such wicks don't burn well, and therefore the Chachamim don't want you to use them because you're going to end up, because you're going to end up trying to adjust it to make it burn a little better, and according to the Rambam, because then you're just going to end up leaving the room and not having the, and not enjoying the light of the Shabbos candles at all. Next, now we're going to turn to oil, to fuels. V'loy b'zefes, you're not allowed to use for Shabbos candles tar. V'loy b'shava, or wax. Now you can ask, of course, we use wax candles for Shabbos. We'll get to that in the Gemara. V'loy b'shemen kik, you're not allowed to use oil of kik, which we'll see in the Gemara tomorrow what that is. V'loy b'shemen sreifa, not oil that you have a mitzvah to burn, meaning oil of truma, which is tomei, which you have a mitzvah to burn it. You're not allowed to use that for Shabbos candles. We'll eventually see in the Gemara in a couple of blocks, we'll see the reason why. You're not allowed to use that. V'loy ba'alya, you're not allowed to use the fat from the tail of a sheep. You're not allowed to use, because again, it doesn't get drawn up into the wick easily. V'loy ba'chelev, or with chelev, the hard fat from an animal. Nochem amadi, I remember licking the chelev mabushel. Nochem amadi says you are allowed to use the chelev, which was heated up, which was boiled. And you have machlokes, because we're showing him what does Nochem Amadi mean? Does he mean if it's boiled and is still liquid, or does he mean that it was boiled and then it congealed again? Anyway, he holds that such thing, chelev like that was heated up like that does burn well. The Chum say no. Echad mevushel v'echad sheni mevushel. Whether it was boiled, whether it was not boiled, a mabikin though, you're not allowed to light Shabbos candles with it. Now, it sounds like they're saying the same thing as the Tanna Kamma, and the Gemara eventually, in a couple of dafim, is going to explain what the actual machloikas is. You have a three-way machloikas over here about this chelev. Okay. So the Gemara starts with definition. Lachesh, the first thing we said in the Mishnah that you can't use, lachesh is soicha da'arza, is a branch of a cedar tree. What do you mean? Soicha da'arza, it's ba'almahu. Obviously, you can't use a branch of a cedar tree. It's wood. You can't use wood. Wood doesn't work for a wick at all. The answer is the Gemara says, "Bam yirnisa de'ispe." We mean, as we just said at the end of the previous paragraph, the woolly stuff that you find under the bark of it—that's the kind of thing where conceivably you could make wicks out of it, but nevertheless you're not allowed to because they don't burn well. We said below the choisen. We said the next thing you're not allowed to use is choisen. So what is choisen? Amar Rav Yosef, the odas shel pishdan. It means the combings of flax. When you have flax grows as fibers inside a stem. So you have there's a process over there of breaking down the stem and getting out the fibers. After that, what you do is you comb out the fibers, and in particular, you get out any pieces of the stem that are still stuck in there. You get out the shorter fibers that are not going to make good thread. So Rabbi Yosef is saying that's what choisen is. It means these short broken pieces of flax. On the lay Abaya says, what do you mean? No, you have a pasuk in Yeshaya that says v'hoya ha-choson l'na'oras. You have a pasuk that says that the choson, which the Gemara is assuming that choson is the same thing as choson of our Mishnah, will become the oras. So we see that choson is not an oras. The father choson lav na'oras. Elo, I'm going to buy a kitten in the diet for nothing. So Abaye says, you're right. No. So we have to say, therefore, that choysen of our Mishnah means actually it is talking about linen, but it's talking about the linen was pounded in order to soften the fibers, but it wasn't combed out. So because it wasn't combed out, therefore, so at that point, it's called choysen. At that point, because when it wasn't combed out yet, then it doesn't serve well as a wick. Once it's combed out, then yeah, it burns well and it serves well as a wick. In that case, what the pasuk is saying, when it says v'hoya achosim and oris, is saying like as a muscle that among the Jewish people, if they don't do tshuva and the Beis Mikdash ends up having to be destroyed, that even the stronger people, chosin, it's actually a sort of play on words, because the word chosin means strong, and it also means, as we're saying, the fibers of the flax. So those will become, like in the Otis, those will become like the weaker fibers, meaning that even the stronger people among the Jewish people are going to end up becoming weak and not be able to withstand the enemies. So anyway, so that's what Choytzen is then. So we're saying it's the flax that hasn't been combed out yet. Okay. We said in the Mishnah of Eloi B'Koloch, we said that you're not allowed to use Koloch for wick. So what is Koloch? So Shmuel says, I asked all of the people who go to the sea, all the sailors and all the traders who trade, who do international trade, the Amili, and they said to me, Kulcha Shmei, it's something that in Aramaic is called Kulcha. It is, Rashi explains, it's a sort of seaweed or something that grows on rocks. Actually, Rashi doesn't mention it, but other Rishonim mention it. It's a stuff that grows on rocks in the sea. It's a sort of some kind of seaweed, basically. So that's one opinion. Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Ze'ira Amar Gushtera. Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Ze'ira says that no, Koloch of our Mishnah is not the seaweed that you're talking about. It's rather the psoilus of silk. Now you have silk is made like this. You have certain kinds of worms, silk worms, that make for themselves cocoons. They spin for themselves cocoon made out of silk. And then what you do is you get the silk by unwinding the cocoon, and then you get the silk thread. So therefore, so we're saying you have the leftovers of it. You have the leftover silk would be something that's also to make wicks out of because it doesn't burn well. Because the flame jumps around or whatever. So the Gemara tells in this connection, Rovin v'Abaya have a Yosvi kameh the Rabbi Rabbanu Nechemia Achor Deresh Kabosa. Rovin and Abaya one time were sitting in front of Rabbanu Nechemia, who was the brother of the Resh Kabosa. So of course, he being that his brother was the Resh Kabosa, he was going to be wearing expensive clothing. Chazia to have a lavish metaksa. They saw that he was wearing silk. He was wearing a silk kapata or something. Robin says to Abaya, Hainu Koloch Disnan. You should know this stuff that he's wearing, the silk that he's wearing, that's the Koloch of our Mishnah, which we're saying you're not allowed to use for wicks. Amalei, so Abaya says, actually, Anan Shira Pranda Korean Light. We actually call this material something else. We don't call it Koloch, we call it Shira Pranda. Shira is a word that's used in a number of places in the Gemara for silk. It actually comes from a Latin word for silk. So Abaya is telling him, you should know we call this stuff Shira Pranda, which means, in other words, so the Maharam explains that the Maharam explains Robin is trying to say that when our Mishnah says you're not allowed to use Koloch, means any kind of silk. And Abaya is telling him that, no, it's only, as we said, the soilus of the silk, only the leftovers that you're not allowed to use. But regular silk itself, you would actually be allowed to use. So the Gemara says, Macy, I have a contradiction. You're telling me that regular silk is called Shira Pranda. What we learn in Abraisa, Hashiroim. The question is going to be on Robin, rather. The question is, Robin is saying that all silk is also called Koloch. What we learn in Hebraica, Hashiroim, silk, Vakoloch, and Koloch, so we see there are two separate things, Vahasirikin, and another kind of very soft silk called Sirikin, all of them Chayav and Besitis, all of them are Chayav and Besitis. In other words, Rashi says, this Hebraica is telling us, not like an opinion that says in Masech the Menachos that only woolen linen clothes are Chayav and Besitis. This Hebraica is telling us that clothes made out of other material, for example, these various kinds of silk, are also Chayav and Besitis. maybe Doraisa, maybe Dirabonon. Anyway, the point is the Braisa mentions Shiroyim.
Is that the case?
Yeah, the halacha is that all kinds of garments are chayiv and tzitzis, although there are Rishonim Hulurim based on the Gemara over there, that only wool and linen are chayiv and tzitzis Doraisa, which is why we try to wear, which is why we Lubavitcher Chassidim try to be mahadir to wear only wool and tzitzis. Because that way we're for sure being a kind of mitzvah on a daraisa level. If we wear, for example, like the belt, many people in the belt wear cotton tzitzis, let's say, so you have, fine, but there are opinions of Rishonim who say that cotton tzitzis are not chayav daraisa. Okay, anyway, the point is that when the braisa is mentioning shivayim and kolach separately, the cure for the Robin, wouldn't this be a contradiction to Robin, who said that all silk is called, that all silk is called kolach? But nothing, you're right, cure, you're right, it would be a contradiction. Or maybe not necessarily is it a contradiction. Maybe is it not necessarily a contradiction. Shira l'chud, but shira pran l'chud. Because Abaya had pointed out that silk is actually called shira pranga. So therefore, we could say that there's a difference between plain shiroyim, which is what the Braisa had mentioned, versus shira pranga. So we would say, in other words, there's a special kind of silk, which is called, shira. In other words, there's regular silk, which is called shira. In other words, there's different grades of silk. There's one grade which is called just plain shira. There's another one which is called shira pranga, and that is the same one which Robin is calling kolach. So therefore, so you could say that, again, when our Mishnah says you're not allowed to use kolach, it might mean, as a buyer is saying, all kinds of silk, or not necessarily, it might mean one particular kind of silk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's that. And we'll continue tomorrow, Bez Hashem, with the definitions of the rest of the things in the Mishnah. Also tomorrow, by the way, we're going to be beginning, Bez Hashem, tomorrow we're going to begin the sugya about Hanukkah. Which is enormous after, because once we're talking about lighting Shabbos candles, then we also talk about lighting Hanukkah candles.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.